right. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling okay.
Yeah.
Better than I was earlier.
Yeah, you came in
a little on the hungover side.
Yeah.
It happens. When it's your birthday, people just give you alcohol for free.
Just random people you run into on the street. They're like, here, take this.
Somehow
like,
they just knew.
Like clearly. A dude I just met last night bought me a couple shots.
Yeah.
He was friends with a friend of mine, but he was like, oh, just put it on my tab.
He was like, it's your birthday.
And yeah, something whatever like that. And then also the bar and gave me a shot. And
it got hazy.
Yeah. And there was no driving involved, so that was a good thing.
Yeah.
But that was a good old-fashioned drunk getting on.
Yeah.
Well, every so often you got to do one of those. The kind where you wake up maybe fully clothed.
You wake up fully clothed in the middle of the afternoon going like, where am I? And it's, oh,
how did I get
your own house?
Yeah. How did I get in this front yard?
Like,
sure.
Well, it all worked out well. Like, I had a good time. Also, that's a good reminder why it's not a good idea to get really drunk when you're 43.
Well, happy belated, Ryan.
Yes, happy birthday, Ryan.
Thank you.
We have many, many things to discuss today. So I think we should go ahead and skip on and play some music. I'm Shane.
Ryan.
I'm Kevin.
And Mark.
Somebody likes it. Thank you. Okay, so there are a few things I would like to discuss today. They both involve odd gentlemen.
Eccentric folk.
That both create or have created incredible music.
True.
But are eccentric men, as it were. And the first I want to talk about is Morrissey. And his he's just released a novel, and I want to read some excerpts from it. Let's just say
it's getting really good reviews, right? Really good,
great,
astounding.
Are you dripping with irony right now?
Yes. Yeah. There's a picture. I'm going to read you some of the review from The Guardian.
Maybe not the astounding part.
There's a picture of Morrissey, and then the caption says, "Morrissey, don't give up your evening job." I'll just give you one little thing. It says, "Do not read this book, no matter how temptingly brief it seems. It is an unpolished turd of a book, the stale excrement of Morrissey's imagination."
What was the two word review in the Spinal Tap movie? It was for the album Shark Sandwich. And the two-word review was shit sandwich.
Yeah. So here, I'm going to read. This is how Morrissey describes the book. This is a quote. The theme is demonology, the left-handed path of black magic. It is about a sports relay team in 1970s America who accidentally kill a wretch who, in esoteric language, might be known as a fetch, a discarnate entity in physical form. He appears, though, as an omen of the immediate deaths of each member of the relay team. He is the life force of a devil incarnate, yet in his astral shell he is one phase removed from life. The wretch begins a banishing ritual of the four main characters, and therefore his own death at the beginning of the book is illusory. End quote.
What'd you call me?
And that's Morrissey's...
Dude.
It's a succinct description of his own book.
I was about to go
book.
Take a nap.
Okay. Well... So one thing I want to read, it goes without saying that the reviewer can't stand this book in the review of it when he says, do not read this book. That's all you need to say. But here is, let's just say that he writes.
Well, I see the header over here. It says Morrissey is still hugely hung up about sex.
Yeah, I'm about to read a sex scene or part of a sex scene that he wrote. Let's just say, you know, Morrissey's never been known to be one to he's not so much a lusty fellow, if you understand
what
I'm saying.
He contends that he's not asexual, but
celibate.
Abstinent.
Well, celibate, he used to, but you found out in his autobiography, at least, that he has, you know, had sex.
I tried to read that book, and I couldn't do it.
Well, this sounds even worse. So here's part of a sex scene. Eliza and Ezra rolled together into the one giggling snowball of full-figured copulation, screaming and shouting as they playfully bit and pulled at each other in a dangerous and clamorous roller coaster coil of sexually violent rotation, with Eliza's breast barrel rolled across Ezra's howling mouth, and the pained frenzy of his bulbous salutation extenuating his excitement as it smacked its way into every muscle of Eliza's body except for the otherwise central zone.
I saw Howling Mouth play Wembley in 79, and they're really great.
So I have a question. Is Morrissey like an extraterrestrial who just learned English
right.
and like observed sexual activity?
It sounds like they're rolling down a hill. Is that what's happening?
I don't know, but how do you barrel roll breasts across someone's howling mouth?
I'm picturing
that
like that.
Someone who's maybe not so experienced.
Well, I highly recommend it. If anybody wants to go read this, just Google Guardian review of Morrissey's novel.
Morrissey still has scores to settle. Part one.
Oh yeah, there's all kinds. So he goes through sort of lays out, puts a lot of dialogue and whatever examples in there, and it's a hilarious
sure
read.
Is now on his enemies list.
Oh yeah. Apparently,
I guess he'll cancel his concert there then.
Okay, so there's one down. Another thing I want to talk about today,
Father John Misty,
is Father John Misty, and
he is an eccentric gentleman.
He is an likewise.
But he's firing on all cylinders right now.
Yeah, see, Morrissey is just, I mean, and again, I say this as a huge fan of the Smiths and of a lot of his solo work, but that dude was already weird when he was in his 20s, and now he's 56, and he's just getting weirder. And
he's a little off the rails at this point.
More and more bizarre. So, there's Father John Misty. The reason he popped up last week is because last week, Ryan Adams
covered in entirety Taylor Swift's 1989.
Right. And so then Father John Misty took, I don't know, two of the songs that I know of, and he recorded them in the style of the Velvet Underground. They're two of the songs from 1989, and he put them up with the posting, I've recorded two songs from Brian Adams' classic album, 1989.
Did he say Brian Adams?
Oh, no, he said Adams, sorry.
Because that would be funnier, too.
Yeah.
It would be, yes.
By the way, this is what I want to do for my A Few Minutes With, so we'll hold off on...
Oh, with the song?
I mean, the Current Affair.
Oh, okay. Good idea. Okay, so you'll hear it later in the show, but he sings them in the style of Lou Reed. And then he took them down a couple days later, and his rationale for doing that, he wrote a really long Facebook post that I would like to share with you, because... it's everything that I love about Father John Misty, how truly...
Well, this was his explanation why he took them down.
Okay, so...
It wasn't a couple of days. It was like 12 hours.
Later. Yeah. I couldn't remember if it was the same day or the next day, but... So this is his Facebook post, and I'm gonna skip around a little bit, but man... I'll try to skip around a little bit, but it's all great. It goes... I had a very strange dream that I abruptly woke up from around 3 a.m. early this morning. I was crab walking around a neighborhood in New Orleans that, though it does not exist, is a reoccurring location in my dreams. My childhood friend Brian Kawamura was telling me that I still owed the tennis rental place $7,000 when the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan was suddenly standing over me saying over and over, "The only thing crazier than a peasant who believes he is king is a king who believes he is a king." And then he put one of those birthday Burger King crowns on my head, and out of the clouds, a sort of switched-on Bach version of Ode to Joy began to play. A crowd which had formed around me began to sing along, with tears streaming down their faces. The earth became a sort of treadmill, and though the locations, the Great Wall of China, a McDonald's where I had my third birthday, Barack Obama... offered to give me a ride on Air Force One. He told me he needed urgent advice regarding some important policy decisions, and we spent the day in Hawaii playing basketball, petting his dogs, golfing, and the like.
The long and the short of this this is his explanation for why he took down the songs that he had covered.
And so then at the end of it, it says, down inside the blob, I could see thousands of familiar faces, and one of them was Lou Reed on a catwalk handcuffed to supermodels who had adopted babies handcuffed to them. And Lou said, delete those tracks. Don't summon the dead. I'm not your plaything. The collection of souls is an expensive pastime. Then I woke up. So he took them down. If this really was his dream, he has an amazing dream recall. And this is also the weirdest goddamn dream I've ever heard of in my life. This is the shit this dude dreams, no wonder he's so goddamn weird.
Well,
Morrissey novel.
Uh-huh. It does.
Well, I went back and listened to the original Taylor Swift version, and then I listened to the Ryan Adams version, and I got about halfway through that, and it was really boring. By far the best one is Father John Misty's.
Well,
and it's spot on.
You know, the other thing is, I will say that Taylor Swift's version of Heroin is really amazing.
I'll bet.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
27 minutes long. Heroin shit.
Waiting for her, man.
Yeah. I was like, I just want to listen to the song on the beach with a syringe and whatever. Like,
okay. So, tonight.
Tonight, we're on Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder's Songs on the Key of Life. And I just want to say real quick, guys, so I didn't realize how long this album was.
It's
almost 2 hours long. I did not know that. I was unfamiliar with it.
This record sold more than any other record the year that it came out, except for Rumors.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It's a great album.
But you have to break it up. Like, I there's no way, like, I don't have that much time in the day to sit and listen to this much music at one
time. But there were a few that you don't have to, you're like, oh yeah, I've heard that. You know, Sir Duke, there's no need for any of us to have to listen to that song.
I enjoy Sir Duke.
It's fantastic.
No, it's a great. Yeah. I'm saying it's a great song.
Why you should know Sir Duke?
I'm not asshole. This is where. That's actually where this. Well, okay. I really, really like this record.
Oh, it's fantastic.
But I feel like it starts out really strong, and then it kind of the first song, "Love's in Need of Love Today."
Like the second LP is not as strong as the first.
I disagree with that, but
that's the one that probably rewards repeated listening.
Well,
as far as I'm concerned,
what I think is the first song's really good, and then you have like these three songs I didn't think were as good. With the worst song of the album is "Contusion," like with its like jazz, you know, fusion
funky
thing. And then from Sir Duke all the way through the rest of the first side. All the way through until the last, I think the last four songs on the album aren't as strong, right.
I think the backstory on this record is really fascinating, like not the least of which is that he was prepared to, like, he was about ready.
He's
already
walk away.
Wildly successful. Yeah. He's about ready to walk away and go feed people in Ghana. And get out of the music. Like, they were planning.
I kind of wonder if that was just kind of a negotiating tactic.
Well, the way that it kind of gets written about it is, like, it's very glossed over. It's like, oh, this is going to happen. And then, oh, by the way, he signed a $37 million record deal in 1976 dollars, which is like, oh, yeah, Ghana can wait.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. They won him over. Well, I mean, this is, it's pretty amazing.
He could just go to the Lower East Side. He wouldn't really know the difference.
Yeah, I don't know. Hey, you guys, anybody here from Ghana?
Jesus.
I don't know. And frankly, in New York in 1976, it might have been a little touch and go. Ghana might have been safer.
It's interesting to me. Like, this is, I mean, if nothing else, this album is incredibly ambitious.
But hugely ambitious. And as much as I think it's overlong, it's hard to argue with him because he was just in the zone and he just wanted to fucking do every little whim that occurred to him.
Yeah, and not all of it completely succeeds. But
I will say this: I must have heard "Isn't She Lovely" dozens of times on the radio, and it's definitely been a radio edit because I kept thinking that song was going to end, and it doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't. Yeah,
really long time.
I listened to that song just because that's one of my favorite Stevie Wonder. It's just it's a perfect.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's a perfect pop song.
Not very many people know this, that when by the time that song actually ends, his daughter is grown.
That sounds about right.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. I'm all about the fun
facts. She's receiving her diploma from Dartmouth.
Isn't she in college is what the next version of that song
that's
is called.
Expensive.
No, I was like, I was listening to it, and I'm like driving to work, and I'm like, oh, this should be just about done. I tap on my phone, and I was only two-thirds of the way through the song, and the rest of it, it's all coda. Like,
yeah. The music stuff.
Yeah, it's like a joke or something. I don't know.
It's not a joke.
Well, I know, but like I don't know. It's like that where you try to go get in the car and they keep pulling up, you know.
Oh, like the dude, like the ambulance in that video we watched a couple
weeks
ago.
Yes, exactly like that.
Yeah, why don't we listen to "Isn't She Lovely"? That's a lovely song.
It is a lovely song.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of that, Mark. Idea was it to not release that song as a single? Can you believe that wasn't
that was not released as
it
a
was
single?
Not a single.
Well, how did it end up on the radio all the time?
Well, I mean, because you gotta remember, like, that album came out like when, like, you know, what was it, AOR radio, like album oriented radio was on, so they, you know, they went away from the top 40 format. They were playing deeper cuts. That was their thing. So I'm sure that that's
some radio programmer
heard it.
Yeah.
Someone heard
it. This is amazing.
Yeah.
And then they just didn't play the second half of the song.
Right.
I mean,
chop 5 minutes off it. Then.
Yeah. How long is that song actually?
It's 6 minutes and 34 seconds.
Okay. All right. The radio edit could be a minute and a half.
You know, I think that's probably why they didn't release it as a single, because the two singles, Sir Duke and I Wish, which are both great songs, they're like right around 4 minutes, both of them. You know, a lot shorter. I think nobody told themselves, oh, you know, let's just go and do a radio edit. You know, some of that harmonic. Which, by the way, can we all just admit, like, who harmonica and R&B, like, if that's happening, it's got to be Stevie Wonder that's doing it. Like, that's not an instrument that shows up. A harmonica does not show up very often in R&B songs.
No, he's kind of a master of the harmonica. Like, he,
yeah, it's just one of his things. It's like the clavichord. Like, you don't ever hear the clavichord played by anybody but Stevie Wonder, because if you do, it just sounds like you're trying to rip off Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, I'm going to come out with my big Juice Harp album here pretty
soon.
That's
not a bad idea.
Yeah.
That's a really underrepresented instrument in the rock world canon.
That's a solid plan, Ryan.
Well, it's my retirement.
I think what you should release an album where it's just only Juice, like Juice Harp
and theremin, maybe,
and like vocals,
yeah,
and like some really bad drum machine programming. Oh God, why are you recording this?
If so,
okay,
why?
Because we need to not forget this. Okay,
well, you got to get that done before this goes out.
Yeah.
Somebody will steal your idea.
Sure. Well,
that's true.
That.
Yeah, somebody's going to go patent the thing.
And then you're like, there goes my pile of money.
Yeah.
Well, this is a great, great, very great song.
Isn't She Lovely?
It's a lovely
song. It's about
song.
His daughter.
Mm-hmm. I never knew that until on this album edit. I always thought it was about some chick. But then at the when the
well, that's true.
Well, it's sort of true.
Yeah, well, okay, right.
Technically
but
a chick.
He this version of the song, there's like a baby, you know, like cooing or what, making some kind of noise, I don't know. And then I'm like, oh, that's about his kid.
Sure enough.
Because that would be a really odd juxtaposition if the song were about some woman
some
that he
like
thought was hot
that,
and yeah. he starts the song with baby noises.
Well, and it's funny, like so dude's been blind since birth. Like,
it's true.
You know, he was born premature, and there was a, you know, some sort of condition in the hospital that made him blind. And so you have to kind of filter that through. And I've actually met a guy who's always been blind, and I was like...
Wait, I don't know. He was blind since birth. I think he lost his sight from, like, scarlet.
From what I read, it was a condition in the hospital. Like, he had too much oxygen, and coupled with the fact that he was premature, it... detached his retinas.
They weren't
fully developed when he was born.
You know, I think I'm thinking of like Ray Charles, you know.
Oh,
some
sure.
Other blind.
Same thing, you know.
Dude.
Blind black guy who plays music.
Good God.
So I did meet a blind gentleman who'd been blind his whole life. And I was just curious. I was probably, I don't know, 23, 24. And I was like, you know, so you're into women, right? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, how do you know? Because, like, us as dudes, like, we typically look at women.
You lead with the senses that you have.
I think it's people. Yeah. People typically look at people.
Well, no, and he was
people.
Like, oh, they smell really good and they're really soft. And I was like, all right, dude. Yeah, I'll buy that.
Yeah.
So it kind of, that going into this record kind of helped inform me, you know, with songs like, well, Isn't She Lovely, or, you know, whenever, like, he's talking about something that you would normally think a visual feel.
I was going to say a visual metaphor. Yeah.
I couldn't go through the podcast without invoking the language of the self-declared dean of rock journalism.
Robert Christgau? Yeah,
yes. Who
wrote, how did we guess that?
Yeah, stereo.
Exactly. So... he wrote an article for the Village Voice, headlined "Stevie Wonder is a masterpiece," and I will not. And it reads, I don't know. I mean, there are tinges of Father John Misty in here too. But
oh, please,
yeah,
carry forth.
So yeah. He says. So if we've forgotten for a moment why this artist is with his, quote, serious news for everybody, end quote, we are now obliged to remember this is Stevie Wonder. He is black and considers that an advantage. He is blind and given to mystic visions. His music is both meticulous and wildly expressionistic. His words combine a preacher's eloquence with an autodidact's clumsiness. And a small detail, in one of his best and favorite jokes, he impersonates a disc jockey, everybody's friendly announcer. Like... What? What is that even?
Yeah, that guy's a little in love with his own writing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, that's some navel gazing right there.
Yeah. But anyway, he goes on to sort of draw a conclusion, which I think is kind of interesting. He says, only two things are clear. First, this man is too secure in his own artistic power to concern himself with quibbles. He doesn't worry about whether we think he's wise or foolish, careless or precise. Second, this music is so audacious and so gorgeous that it seems pointless for us to worry about it either.
Well, so I like
that's
that.
Interesting.
Yeah,
like, yeah.
I can
no, it makes sense.
That.
And like, definitely, there's not a whole lot of editing going on in this record.
No.
What I was kind of thinking of is like, I mean, it's a beautiful record, and any, just about any song on it, taken on its own, is a just a brilliant thing. And they're all good songs, and he's you know, at the top of his craft for sure. But it's like, hey man, maybe release two records.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's something to be said for that. Well, I mean, like I said, there's you if you start with song five, and you which is Sir Duke, and you go all the way down through the end of side three, and leave off just side four, which is, you know.
Well, and that's what I was talking about when I was. Saying it kind of,
I mean, that's just
peers
the way that
out.
I feel about it. And those songs aren't bad songs, but I mean, that is just a run
99%
of sheer genius before that.
Yeah, 99% of musicians would, you know, cut off a limb to record side four, but
it's true.
It's just not where his strengths lay in this. Like,
it gets that's really probably in a lot of ways the most ambitious set of. I mean, they're all really ambitious. Can I just state for the record though that one thing that really kind of grated on me a little bit was those early synthesizer string sounds just kind of got under my skin just a little bit. Not enough to really take. I think that's why I don't like Village Ghetto Land, which is a pretty good song, but those fake string sounds just kind of just pulled me out of it.
Well, I think he was just kind of experimenting with everything he could
sure,
get his
but,
hands on.
But that goes back into what you were saying, you know, about there's no editing.
No, there's nobody telling him no. Like, it was just like, all right, Stevie.
Which is really ballsy if you think.
Well, and, you know, he got his first recording contract when he was 11.
Yeah.
And pretty much had success from then on out. And that's sort of what happens when... You know, you get your mindset stuck, you know, when you're a child, like, oh, I can just do whatever I want. I'm going to.
Right. You know what's fun? He's an amazing drummer. And he doesn't play on that much of this record, drum-wise, I don't think. One thing I wanted to point out about the ambitious part of it that I think is really ballsy is that he signed that incredibly large contract, and this is the first album he puts out after that. I mean, it's just it's a lot of balls, I think. Because, I mean, not because it's not good, just because it is so ambitious. There's so much going on, and it's so big. They charged a shit ton of money for it, right? Like, a lot more than albums normally were charged or whatever.
I don't know. It was 1976, so it was probably like 12 cents.
Let me share. I'm going to share one last little Chris Goud nugget, because I think it's amusing. He says, granted that studio double LPs invariably dish up too much new stuff to digest comfortably, and that Wonder's cannily self-indulgent decision to add a fifth side in the form of a 7-inch 33 that looks like a 45.
Oh, yeah, there's an extra EP on it.
Yeah. Has added to the sense of the surfeit. Granted, too, that as a promotional arrangement whereby a gaggle of journalists was flown to the country to listen once to the forthcoming release date didn't clarify things any. And granted, finally, that Stevie Wonder revisits or resists analysts consciously and even aggressively. In the first stanza of Joy Inside My Tears, he apologizes for using the nasty word but. But the analytic weapon that begins this paragraph, it's still possible to figure out what kind of masterpiece this might be. So it's essentially, like, I'm taking a snippet out of a longer arc, but his point is that masterpiece is a crazy word to throw around, because if you use it about more than one of his records, and he said that he doesn't believe that this is his best album, then you start talking about whether something's a genius or not.
There are like three, I think, that are considered. Inner Visions, this one, and what's the other one?
Inner Visions is amazing. I would say that I like that better than this record, though this record is amazing. I don't know. What's the other?
There are three of them. And,
okay.
Well, yeah, I'll look it up. But, yeah, he felt like this is up there, but not maybe his best record.
Well, I'm reading through this too. A minute ago, I said, like, he's an amazing drummer. He doesn't play drums on most of this. So it looks like now I misspoke. Like, he did play a lot more drums than I thought. And you can really tell his style of drumming too, because there's so much going on. He's the most hi-hat expressive drummer I can think of. Like, he uses the hi-hat a lot. There's a lot of that stuff going on.
Talking Book.
Yeah, that's a great album too.
Yeah.
The dude is a fucking genius, though. It goes without saying.
No, and like he's got the most singular voice of just about anybody I've ever
heard.
His
singing voice?
Yeah.
That's what I was just about to say. It's beautiful. He's such an incredible singer. I could listen to him sing just about anything. That's why there even the songs on here that I don't like, the one that I like the least, I don't think it's coincidental, is the one he doesn't sing on, Contusion.
Yeah, so. I can't hear that word without hearing it in Ice-T's voice, now that I've been watching Law & Order SVU.
Right.
Contusion.
Hey, let's listen to another song real quick. I want to listen to Ordinary Pain, we'll talk about that in just a sec. Don't fool yourself, but tell no one else that it's more. I think we were talking about his voice, and it came to mind immediately. It's one that, because it's a little sedate, not sedate, but
it's a pretty song.
It's sparser and than a lot of these songs. You can, it really shows off his voice. And then it gets a little crazy. It's another example of.
There's a lot of crazy on this record.
It's true.
I wouldn't say this is one of the crazier ones. Like there's more experimentation I think that goes on in the second half of it.
I didn't look at it as except for the fourth side.
As experimentation?
No. I saw. I agree with the experimentation. I was just like you keep saying like the first half and the second half and which takes more time to build up. And I mean, to me, it's remarkably consistent with the quality of the songs and with the fact that with the denseness of it. Like it's a really dense record. And the guy can write hooks. I mean,
for sure. No, he was Babe Ruth in 31 or
27.
Whatever. Yeah, something like that. Like he was in the zone at this point. So I understand him trying to just do as much as he possibly could, but it's a lot to take in. Like if we really wanted to do a deep dive on this record, like it would take probably two or three shows.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, there's a lot going on. It's really dense. Okie dokie. Well, we'll talk about it. What?
Okie dokie.
Okie dokie. No, okie dokie, Smokey.
I'm just going back to Demetra Martin.
I don't remember.
It's funny. Well, yeah, we won't, to quote Kevin, go down that rabbit hole. But
Go back and listen to that show in its entirety. Then come back to this point in this show.
Yeah.
And then we'll be good.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, catch up. That sounds good to me. Okay, well, we're going to do a few minutes with Kevin Has It Tonight, so let's play some intermission music.
Let's do it.
Tonight I've chosen I'm not sure whether this was one of David Letterman's favorite songs or Paul Shaffer's favorite songs or both of them, but these guys would lose their shit whenever the Orwells would come on and play Letterman. And so
the Orwells?
The Orwells.
I'm not familiar.
So
me neither.
Yeah. So anyway, and it was one of these that we talked about that on this show quite a bit, but like as Letterman's show, like as his career wound down and they were getting ready to throw everything out, like they just started doing, as probably we all would, just whatever the hell they wanted. And so they would only, and they booked really, continued to book really good bands. And one of the bands that Paul Shaffer and David Letterman just fawned over were the Orwells. And it's funny too, because they don't necessarily meet. They don't sound like, you know, like
they don't sound like a 60-year-old man music.
No, they don't sound like 60-year-old man music at all. So anyway, this song is a great version of it. And it's like, it's one of the ones that like at least one time when they came on that show, Letterman tried to get them to, they played this song that we're going to listen to. And then he tried to get them to play it again, like the whole thing.
Really?
Yeah. And then when they like were sort of hedging on that a little bit, it was like Paul Shaffer and the band started to play it. Like, it was a thing. So, anyway, and again, this doesn't sound like anything that Paul Shaffer and that band would have played. But it's kind of stuck with me as something that would be fun to try it out in the middle.
Well, let's check it out.
Let's do it. The name of the track is Who Needs You, And as they would, like, well, two things, really. One, not a ton of narrative in that video, I think it's fair to say.
It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty straightforward. We're just going to rock out a little bit.
Yeah. And then the second thing is like, if you can imagine it, is, like, when they would play that last Letterman appearance, it's, like, that whole, like, you better this, you better that, like, that whole series of stand-ups, it's, like, the Schaefer Band would start making up their own, like,
you better, riffing on it.
You better keep on playing or whatever. Yeah. The guys just looked like half bewildered. It was great.
When was that? Like how long ago did this song come out? Like recently?
Within the past 3 years. Like,
yeah, there's a lot. That was a cool song.
Oh, it's a fantastic song. Yeah. It did seem to me like if the Strokes were fronted by Ian Asbury of the Cult.
Yeah, there were a lot of different references, but I like how they, and then they had like that chiming 12-string guitar, like electric guitar thing going that sounded like the Birds, kind of, like in the middle of it.
No, it's a fantastic song. A
lot of different influences, but kind of had its...
I like how you pronounce that.
Influences? Yeah.
You put the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yes. But they still sounded sort of like it was of its own. I mean, you can pick out the different
certainly
things.
You can see like who they've listened to as youths.
Yeah. But the one thing I thought was really funny about the video and also and the lyrics is though that they're like playing. It's just a band performance video. They're playing in front of a giant American flag, and then there are all of these like flashing like symbols of war and capitalism and like all the stuff he's saying, they're just like these vague things to rebel against.
That was actually really funny. Yeah. It's like his whole thing like is like
No way, Uncle Sam.
At one point he says, "I say no thank you." Like, and I was like, that is a little bit of a Ryan Newsom line right there.
There was a lot of just vague stuff to rebel against is what it seemed like to me.
But
good song.
They mostly commenced with the rocking.
Absolutely. They commence with the rocking. Yeah. And thank you for introducing us to this.
I'm sure that a little bit of sleuthing will turn up that last Letterman appearance and all of the hectoring that went on trying to get those guys to continue to play. Because, like, if you ever go to one of those shows, well, most of them work on the same format, but the band only gets, like, one song.
It's true.
That's the exact format.
Yeah. So, anyway, they wanted them to keep playing that song. Over and over and over.
It's pretty great. Good song.
Thanks.
Yeah, I can't believe I've never even heard of that band.
I've never heard of that band or that song.
Yeah, it's weird.
That'll be $5.
No.
Okay. Can I write you an IOU?
Sure.
Okay, so let's go back to Stevie Wonder.
Little Stevie Wonder?
Yeah, Little Steve. Was it Little
it
was Steve?
Well, it was Little Stevie Wonder.
I know, but
it was prior to the LIL apostrophe.
Yeah, a little.
This is probably about medium sized Stevie Wonder.
By this time, he's considerable now.
He's the size of his own talent now.
He's large Stevie Wonder now.
He has largesse.
All right, yeah, let's go back and talk about Songs of the Cube Life.
Fountain, you want to come in?
I was reading the list of there's over 100 people that performed on this album.
On most records.
Yes, most of them. I mean, granted, most of them are percussion or background singers, but
Herbie Hancock has got keyboards and hand clapping.
Yeah, there's one of the songs has like some Hare Krishna Center. They're performing background vocals. But what I like the very last one. Is his daughter. She's credited with crying on Isn't She Lovely. And then I noticed right before that, it says Fountain Jones Programming.
And Shane shared with us right before we came back in.
I'd like to change my name to Fountain, and Ryan suggested that just be my street name.
Yeah, it'd be Shane...
Fountain?
Fountain Bartel?
No, Fountain Jones. I don't know. Regardless, I want to know if he was named Fountain or if that was his street name.
Fountain Jones, like you could either be a musician or a pimp.
Or a pen.
But
or a pen. You could be a pen.
Anyway. One of the things I wanted to read you a little bit. There's in the same AV Club article, which I showed you guys the picture of Stevie Wonder in his Roy Rogers outfit.
that he randomly picked out with no retinas.
It's pretty great. Well, either that, something like that happened, or like he has the worst dresser I mean,
somebody
like,
was playing a cruel joke on him.
I mean, what a like he like the whoever was like picking his stylist like just has no sense. Well, I guess it was the 70s though. I mean, let's
and if
face
you're,
it.
If you're a you know if you're a music a popular musician in the 70s, you can pretty much wear whatever the hell you want. So,
well, if you're blind, you don't give a shit either
yeah,
way.
Exactly.
Yeah. So one thing I want to point out real quick is that so after this album came out, his follow-up album was Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants. And I just want to read what they say about it here in the AV Club. 1979's Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants, a mostly instrumental and truly insane work about the not terribly exciting unseen adventures of stationary green life. Suffice it to say, it did not do as well as Songs in the Key of Life.
Truly insane is the pull quote that I want on the sticker of their record.
Life in the Key of Plants.
Truly insane. AV
truly
Club.
Insane, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's some insane shit that's already going on in this
it's
one
like
anyway.
Eight tracks about like growing and sunshine.
Chlorophyll.
Yeah, like. Exactly.
I just want to read real quick. The Rolling Stone review at the time took him to task for too many excellent songs. The album offers something fresh at each listening, something right for every mood, but it's also one of the record's annoyances. It has no focus or coherence. The eclecticism is rich and welcome, but the overall effect is haphazard, turning out what might have been a stunning exotic feast into a hastily organized potluck supper.
Dude, I couldn't agree more.
I know. That's like, what, that's why I wanted to read that, because I thought that
yeah,
you might.
Yeah, there's like three or four good records here, and they released it all in one giant, you know, I don't want to say dump, but
I mean,
it's too much. It's too much of a good thing.
It is a little too much, but that's a pretty big step down from an exotic feast to a hastily organized potluck dinner. I mean, like that's stepping way down there. Which, by the way, let me say this: Rolling Stone now gives it a 5-star review. Like in retrospect,
oh, and at the time,
yeah, I don't know what the I don't know what the
they've done that with Led Zeppelin too.
Well, and I found the original review. I found the same review that you just read, and one of the things it says is not rated. Like, it had no rating. So I don't know if that's just they've scrubbed it so there's not a uncomfortable pitchfork situation.
Oh, right.
Where you're like,
Did they give stars back then, like in the 70s?
I don't know. Yeah, they're just a
no,
series
they did,
of hand claps.
Yeah, with Led Zeppelin, they gave one of their records, like, a, I don't know, 2 stars or something, and then later on got Religion about it. I'm like, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Oops. My bad. Yeah. You know, they may have. That's funny. That's funny and also bullshit revisionist history. I mean, come on. Own up to it, man. Like, you got it wrong at the time. But, you know.
Well, they figure, like, whoever's reading the magazine at this point, like, wasn't reading it back then. So, you know, who knows? Like, it, you know, it's fine now.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
We'll fix it in post.
Yeah.
Well, this is a good listen. We're gonna listen to one more song.
The earlier teased,
yeah, Sir Duke. Well, I mean, we should listen to one of the singles, and I think it's really interesting to contrast this song because, while catchy, it's not as radio friendly, I don't think, as Isn't She Lovely.
Well, I'd already heard this song a few dozen times, but I never knew what it was called, and I didn't know what it was about. But I do know.
It really, probably depends on the radio.
Yeah. Well, maybe I don't know. Like, oh God.
Anyway.
All right, thank you.
I mean, that's, you know, whatever.
But no, I'm welcome.
Point being, yeah, exactly. Point being,
I do
think it's a fun track, though.
I do like how this album, this song, another one of his good examples of working in interesting instruments is that it prominently features one of those, like, whistles that you blow in that.
Oh, that you get at, like, amusement parks.
Yeah.
Whee!
Yeah, right, exactly. It's got a. It's
how's
got
that?
Yeah, it sounds exactly like that. Remember we were talking before about how you have this uncanny ability.
Michael Winslow-like ability.
You have a Michael Winslow-like ability to emulate sounds. That's just another example.
And thank you. I'm available for children's parties.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's scary.
Here's one coming up. Hey, look. Uncle Ryan's going to go, wee.
He's got a bunch of.
I'll bet Rivers would really appreciate that impression.
She probably would. She's a good crowd.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's hear a little bit of Sir Duke, which, by the way, I'm going to go out on a limb, and I think this song might be about
Duke Ellington.
Maybe.
Maybe. I don't know.
Partly.
You might be right about that.
Okay. Right. Well, let's listen to it. We'll be right back.
which we all understand. With an equal opportunity for all to sing, dance, and clap their hands. Well, just because the record has a groove, don't make it in the groove. But you can tell right away in Dr. A when the people start to move.
So that track is about Duke Ellington, but it's also really about a lot of the great black musicians.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I was
Ella
kidding.
Fitzgerald, yeah. And I think there's a Glenn Miller reference in there. He wasn't black, but like that, you know, sort of like great musicians that came before him. So, yeah.
Yeah, in the jazz and big band era. Good song. It's, you know, there's
just ridiculously hooky.
Oh, well, that's one. If there's nothing else that guy does, well, I think it's really interesting that the two singles that were released off this album, I mean, talk about, especially in the period of time, like that song, which is about Duke Ellington, and, you know, like all the stuff we just talked about. And the other one was I Wish, which is just like songs about him and like being a little kid and stuff, you know.
Anybody else kind of like, I was like, I know that there's no way this is going to happen, but I'm really kind of hoping that this is the original Skee-Lo version of, like...
I Wish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have we played that on this podcast?
Yeah. It
what
was
is
your
that? I don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
I Wish It Was a Little Bit...
Oh, yeah. That's a good song. Yeah, oh, right, right.
Great,
yeah.
Another great song with the same title. So I was like, there's... Yeah. Yeah, Skee-Lo was probably, like, not born yet when that... Or, like, you know, 5 years old when that that song came out. But I was like, that would be...
Well, Stevie Wonder was 25 when they recorded this. Mm-hmm. It was recorded released in 76.
76, yeah.
And he was born in 1950, so he was probably 25.
And this was like, what, his 16th or 17th album?
Something like that. He was 11 when he got signed to Motown.
Yeah. Man has work ethic.
True.
Or something.
That song we talked about earlier, like I had mentioned, speaking of work ethic, I think that's a really good example of like how expressive he is on the hi-hat with his drums. Like, he's a great drummer, but he drums like nobody else but himself. And that's the thing with, I mean, is there anything the man doesn't play, number one? And when he does, like, he sounds like fucking Stevie Wonder. He is a singular
voice.
Well,
he's the only one. And other people try to sound like him. Like, remember Jamiroquai?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure.
Everybody was like, oh, yeah, he sounds like Stevie Wonder. But he was like, you know, really
dude,
a pale imitation.
All right, speaking of pale imitations, what's the name of that fucking dude that's the judge on, one of the judges on the Voice? Adam Levine.
Wapner? Sorry.
No, different show.
Thank you, Rain Man.
Dumbass. Yeah, exactly. Adam Levine, he's a singer for Maroon 5. I remember like reading interviews with him when the band first came out, and he said something. He's like, yeah, I'll go to a party and we'll be playing, and all these people will be like, who's that white boy that sounds just like Stevie Wonder? And I'm like, do you really think that? And he references it, or did all the time. Like, he thinks like he sounds just like Stevie Wonder, which, number one, no, not at all. That's some serious self-delude that he's deluded. But number two, like, stop trying to tie your balloon to, like, this incredibly...
Well, Stevie Wonder is a singular kind of genius.
He is a genius.
And so lots of people have tried to, you know, follow in his wake.
I know, but he's trying, like I'm saying, but he's trying to attach his balloon to that, you know, whatever Stevie Wonder is, and talks about it and references it. Like, there's one thing to attempt to emulate that. There's another to constantly talk about how the two of you sound so much alike.
You know, you made me think about something that I think is kind of interesting, which is that we could, in theory, like, just do a whole show of people who have covered Stevie Wonder stuff, and, like, frankly, it runs the gamut. Like, I'm sort of fascinated by the idea that, you know, that if you are, you look at a work like this where, you know, the guy is a touchstone for so many other artists, but I mean, like, you know, whatever, like...
Honestly,
the Chili Peppers did Higher Ground.
Sure, yeah, and I love their version of it, actually. Yeah, like, that's my, and, you know, as much as you can slag on the Chili Peppers, at that point, they were really, really good.
No, that was before Kiedis had never tried to sing a ballad. Like, that was
it was the record right before that. It was Mother's Milk.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic. And I was actually like,
would have been a better album.
I went to lunch with a guy. I was working at a plastics fabrication shop, and I played like that Chili Peppers version. He was like, "Oh yeah, Stevie Wonder."
Yeah,
and like I had not actually heard
and
the
it's
Stevie
faithful
Wonder version
to the original. Dude, but yeah, have you guys uniquely there?
Have you guys ever heard the story that so Jeff Beck, who was the I may have mentioned this on the show before, but. In which case you would have heard the story, but
Jeff Beck from the Yardbirds.
Yeah, and he also and it was played with Rod Stewart in the 70s. He did a lot of solo stuff, and I guess that he was I don't know 100% know all the details on this, but I guess that he and Stevie Wonder were rehearsing in the same rehearsal complex, something like that, maybe recording in the same studio complex, and he tried. The way the story goes is that he asked Stevie Wonder to write him something, and he said sure, and then. And then wrote Superstitious and then played it for him and then decided he wanted to keep it for himself. Like, and so then they never spoke again. Or so there's a lot of bad blood between the two. Because it's, you know.
That's an amazing song.
It's an amazing song.
Yeah, if I had
Stevie Ray Vaughan covered
it. Yeah. And it's the Stevie Ray Vaughan version is good too, but
it is
no.
good. But it's not. It doesn't have
it's
the.
It's not. It doesn't.
That's what I'm saying. Like I was talking about the clavichord earlier. Like.
I don't know what that is.
It's the instrument it's the key instrument in Superstitious, that particular sound. Like,
what does it look like?
I don't know, dude. It's got like piano keys and shit.
Okay. That's all I need
to
know.
It looks like a Rhodes, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's got a very distinctive sound that once you hear it, if you hear it anywhere else, you're like, oh, that dude's just ripping off Stevie Wonder. You completely associate it with Stevie Wonder.
So is that the thing that sounds like a funky bass?
Kinda, yeah. Yeah, it's got a bass sound in there. Anyway, so yeah, he kept the song and
I would have too, man.
Like, that's what I'm saying.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you guys, thank you for listening to that very long album. Great but good album. And
no, it's great.
Okay, what are we? Oh yeah, we're listening to Father John Misty.
It's not a tease. We're totally going to listen to Father John Misty's cover of, and actually, I don't even remember the name of the song.
It's some Lou Reed song.
In the style of Lou Reed.
I'm kidding.
That's Blank Space, right?
Blank Space. Thank you.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift.
Yeah, there is no accompanying video. Although, man, I would love to see that.
Well, there is not. Maybe he'll have another dream, and then there will be one.
Yeah, I know. That's like, pretty visual, what we talked about earlier. That'll suffice.
Yeah, that was a very specific. Yeah, so just go back and listen to that part while simultaneously listening to this or something.
Got a long list of ex-lovers. They'll tell you I'm insane. 'Cause you know I love the players. Oh, you know I love the players. 'Cause you know I love the players. Woo! Oh, and you love the game. 'Cause we're young and we're reckless and we'll take this way too far. It'll leave you breathless, baby, or with a nasty scar. I got a long list of ex-lovers, and they'll tell you I'm insane. But I got a blank space, baby. Oh, I got a blank space, baby. Oh, I got a blank space, baby, and I'll write your name.
This makes me so very, very, very happy.
Whoo.
Ooh,
mama.
Yeah, it's like
that is the most spot on impression of Lou Reed
or anybody's ever done of anyone ever. Like, holy mother.
It's very amusing.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate. And I really think that in a lot of ways it stays very faithful to Ryan Adams' work.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
It's funny that you say that.
It's funny. Go ahead.
Stop. I thought it actually hewed a little closer to the original, the Swift.
Taylor Swift?
Yeah.
I believe that it did.
Yeah. I actually think she's not a terrible songwriter.
It's fine. Yeah, it's nothing to get excited about.
Yeah, if I was a 14-year-old girl, I'm sure I'd appreciate it much more than I do now.
I heard this interview the other day on NPR, and the host of the of All Things Considered was talking to this guy, and she's like, "What? Why does this 40-year-old man feel like he needs to come and make this into serious music?" Basically, they were just pulling Ryan Adams apart, like as though like he was shitting on her, like doing her a disservice by reinterpreting the album, which I think is a perfectly valid thing for a musician to do. I mean, Mark Kozak has done multiple AC/DC album covers. I mean, like he's taken entire AC/DC albums and like completely
and
done
just
them,
put them through the Sunkill Moon filter.
Yeah, yeah, and he did a Modest Mouse record a few years, or I don't know if it's a Modest Mouse record or if it were just all Modest Mouse songs. I can't remember, but anyway, I think it's a perfectly valid. I mean.
Well, to go a step further, apparently they're friendly, like they're friends.
Like Ryan Adams and Taylor Swift?
Apparently Ryan Adams and Taylor Swift are. Yeah. They've worked together.
Yeah, so in that sense, like...
But
yeah.
I do think that Father Don Misty is just taking the piss.
Oh, yeah. No, oh, totally. Yeah.
No, that's what makes it even funnier. Like when he said, like, two songs in the style of Lou Reed off of Ryan Adams' classic album, 1989.
Yeah, man. Like
that's just good stuff right there, dude.
That's just him just going, like... Fuck these guys, and I'm going to have a really good time doing this.
Well, it sounds like you did. They're laughing a lot at the end of this recording.
Dude, I looked that around, like, within, like, a minute of this song playing, all three of us were wiping away tears of laughter.
It's very amusing. Yeah. It goes on a little bit long.
It does go on a little bit long.
I wish he had shortened it just a little bit, but man,
regardless, I'm happy that this is in my life.
Right. Well, but that's if he had shortened it a little. Me too. But if he had shortened it a little bit, not only would it be funny, but it's not a bad listen either. I mean, like,
no, it's a good song.
It's a good song.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like Velvet Underground, so yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, if you put them through the Father John Misty Velvet Underground filter. Like, turns out Taylor Swift, like, writes a pretty
sounds
good...
Sounds all right.
Yeah, seedy, you know, New York early 70s
her record 1989.
From her record 1989, when she was born, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I want to hear her... What were you saying? Like, we all want to hear her cover of Heroin?
Yeah, well, I just said it's really good.
Oh, it's really good.
Yeah,
it's really good.
I would actually love to hear the upbeat cover of Heroin by Taylor Swift.
The cheery, poppy version of Heroin, yeah.
Or Katy Perry, either one.
Sure. Well, that it'd just make the Sharks do weird stuff. So.
Oh, I forgot about that. That's a good time. Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
So
good.
What's next week?
Tell you what. Why don't we do Marquee Moon by Television?
Oh, okay.
What? Yeah, we'll stay in the CD70s.
I like the CD70s.
Yeah. We'll recreate Mark's garage into a reasonable facsimile of CBGB.
Okay, so let's start pissing in the corners now. So it'll pick up that proper smell by next week.
Yeah. Mark, if you can just have a body in here by the time that we come back.
No worries.
All right. Well, we will see you guys next week. I'm Shane.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Mark.
This was Somebody Likes It.